You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. The second episode of WPR's podcast, Derailed, is available today. Episode 1 of Derailed told the story of how Wisconsin's high-speed train plan was born in the 1990s under then-Republican Governor Tommy Thompson. In episode 2, you'll hear how the Great Recession gave the high-speed rail plan new life. It'll take you through how President Barack Obama's federal stimulus bill came together and what Wisconsin could have gotten out of it. You can get the Derailed podcast at WPR.org/derailed or wherever you stream your podcasts. Now, as the U.S. House moves forward with an impeachment inquiry into President Trump, we're learning more about where Wisconsin's members of Congress stand on the issue. This weekend, Republican Representative Glenn Grothman was on WISN's Upfront. Here's part of an exchange he had with the show's host, Adrian Pederson.
So as long as he is different than what I guess I'll call the swamp, you're going to have a lot of people trying to impeach him. Now, if he did something wrong, we'll see if that comes out today.
Is there doubt in your mind that he might have done something wrong?
I don't think he did something impeachable, but we'll have to see.
Our next guest says, for clues on how Wisconsin's representatives are approaching impeachment, look to the political dynamics in each of their home districts. Craig Gilbert is the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel's Washington Bureau Chief. Craig, thanks a lot for joining us today.
It's great to be with you.
Well, what do we know about how President Trump is faring big picture in our 8 House districts in Wisconsin?
So the 8 House districts, one of them is not represented right now. That's the Northern District, which in some ways is sort of the most pro-Trump district in the state. Sean Duffy resigned, so that seat is vacant and is not going to have a representative participating in the impeachment process. So that leaves 7, 4 Republicans and 3 Democrats. You know, the 4 remaining Republican seats are all Republican seats by, you know, maybe plus 5 or plus 10, depending on how you define it, which means Republicans have a real advantage, not a staggering advantage, but a real advantage in those districts. And that creates a lot of pressure on Republican members of Congress to oppose impeachment, just because Republican voters in those districts oppose impeachment and by and large support President Trump. The districts themselves, you know, President Trump's approval rating is not super impressive, even in the Republican districts. It may be, you know, he may be at 51% or 50% approval and 45% disapproval in a typical Republican district in Wisconsin, which doesn't sound that impressive. But these are Republican seats, and so it's the Republican voters in those districts that those members are paying particular attention to.
We just heard Representative Glenn Grothman there, and that was one of the more qualified statements I think we've heard from Republicans in Wisconsin, but even there, he's not really on board, clearly, with impeachment.
No, but it's also interesting at the same time, they're not on board with impeachment. They're not... you know, they're also being careful about what they're saying about the president's underlying conduct. So, you know, they're opposing the process and they're opposing impeachment, but they're not too eager to defend everything about what the president has done or in the abstract about the prospect of a president, you know, asking a foreign power to investigate his own political rival. So they've been very tight-lipped about that set of issues. And so they're somewhat conflicted, too. But there's also some interesting conflicts on the Democratic side that we can talk about.
Yeah, we'll get to those in a minute. But as you mentioned, in a lot of these Republican districts where the president has net approval, but not by a lot, so are Republicans saying, okay, I don't want to oppose the president too much and risk a primary from within the Republican Party. I don't want to embrace him too much for the purposes of the general election.
Yeah, I think that's basically the dynamic. I mean, I think writ large, Republican members of Congress are, you know, very concerned about, you know, being seen as adversaries of President Trump because of President Trump's sort of ability to kind of marshal support in the Republican base and his history of calling out members in his own party when they criticize him. That's just like they just don't want to go there. And so that's the conflict for them. And so the most comfortable position for them is to kind of criticize the process and criticize the way Democrats are going about what they're doing and not support impeachment. If they have to, maybe make some qualified criticisms of President Trump's conduct. But For all that to change, I mean, there would have to be, I think, new information coming out, and there would have to be some shifts in public opinion.
Talking to Craig Gilbert from the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, we're looking at Wisconsin's congressional delegation and the districts they represent and how they're approaching issues related to impeachment. Let's turn to those Democrats now. Two Democrats pretty strongly in favor of impeachment. Gwen Moore of the Milwaukee area has been talking about it for a couple of years now. Actually, we found clips going back to 2017. And here's Democratic Representative Mark Pocan in Dane County and the surrounding region. He told reporters this week there's already enough evidence to impeach the president. Here's a listen.
He has betrayed his oath of office by asking a foreign leader to dig dirt up on a political opponent. He's admitted that. And he's even given us the notes from a call on that, which I would refer to as evidence.
So let's start with Mark Pocan and Gwen Moore, and their districts could be a slam dunk for them to support impeachment.
Yeah, I don't think there's much ambiguity there. I mean, their districts are overwhelmingly Democratic. One is anchored by Madison and one is anchored by Milwaukee. Very one-sided districts where President Trump is very unpopular. And impeachment has gained ground among Democratic voters. It wasn't always it still isn't, but was never a universally supported position among Democratic voters, but it's gained ground among Democratic voters. You know, it's gone from 60 or 70% to more like 90% in some polls. So all the more, you know, reason why they don't really face any conflicts within their own districts with respect to being kind of aggressive advocates for an impeachment inquiry or ultimately even impeachment itself.
And then there's Democratic Representative Ron Kyde.
Then that's the most interesting case of all, because his district is pretty unusual. It's a district that had been voting Democratic for president, much like the state of Wisconsin, for many years, and then switched and voted for Donald Trump, reflecting, I think, it's a pretty rural district and reflecting Trump's strength in rural communities with rural voters. Ron Kyde is also a centrist Democrat, so he's not as liberal as either Representative Pocan or Representative Moore. And so he does have conflicts because there are Democrats in his district in his own party that support impeachment, but it's a pretty 50-50 district now with respect to its partisan makeup, and it did narrowly vote for Donald Trump by about 4 points. So there's about 30 House members, Democratic House members, and maybe 31 that represent districts that voted for Donald Trump in 2016. And they're in a pretty interesting position. And I think Speaker Pelosi, one of the reasons why she hasn't taken a floor vote to authorize an impeachment inquiry is because she's afraid that it will be seen by voters as being a vote for impeachment per se, and that could hurt some of these Democrats in districts that were very divided or that actually voted for Trump.
And then finally, we've got two members of Congress who represent the entire state of Wisconsin, our two senators. We're a state that can go Democratic or Republican in a presidential race. We can elect a conservative Republican like Ron Johnson. We can elect a liberal Democrat like Tammy Baldwin. Where are they shaking out on all this?
Well, Senator Baldwin kind of held her fire on this issue for a long time, but when Nancy Pelosi announced there would be an impeachment inquiry in the House, she said for the first time that she thought that was a good idea to have an inquiry. So that was a kind of a marker for her. And again, she just won re-election pretty handily, but she's mindful also of the kind of 50-50 politics of her state. And then in the case of Senator Johnson, you know, he's taken a interesting and pretty distinctive role in this debate because he's a lot of Senate Republicans have been very tight-lipped about this. They just, for some of the reasons I alluded to earlier, where they don't want to be out there having to, you know, seeming to endorse the conduct on the part of the president, and they may be uncomfortable with that, but they also, you know, don't want to side with the Democrats. And Senator Johnson has been pretty vocal and much more vocal than a lot of other Republicans in the Senate in kind of sympathizing with President Trump, kind of taking his side, sort of reinterpreting what his remarks in the most positive light possible, and also just really pushing back he's kind of made the case for some of the suspicions on the Republican side for Democratic behavior, for theories about Ukraine's role in the 2016 election. So all the suspicions that Republicans have about how the Mueller report got started against Donald Trump, and he calls it a collusion hoax. That's Senator Johnson speaking. So he's been very aggressive on the flip side of that issue, in complaining vociferously and alleging Democratic mischief against President Trump.
What are you watching for, Craig? I know you follow public opinion in Wisconsin and break it down as far as you can. What are you watching for to see if public opinion shifts one way or another?
So, we don't have a whole long history of polling on the impeachment issue, but certainly in the national polling, there has been an increase, an uptick in support for impeachment. And a lot of that is Democrats becoming more universally supportive of impeachment, and then some increase among independents, and maybe a little bit of increase among Republicans. I think ultimately, and somebody was making this argument today, a Democratic pollster, that the key indicator is going to be his approval rating, President Trump's approval rating. And we do have a long history of that in Wisconsin. And the most striking thing about his approval rating in Wisconsin, as it is nationally, two things really. It's just that it's below water in the sense that there's more disapproval than approval, not by a lot, but he's in the 40s. And it's also just how consistent it has been. It just never changes. So that, in a weird way, that could be an asset for him, because it never gets above 46 or 47, but it never gets below 42 or 43. And when he's at 43, it means that Republicans are supporting him very solidly. And that's certainly enough for him to ward off, to sort of survive an impeachment trial in the Senate, which is controlled by Republicans. So I would watch his approval rating, among other things, to see if that sinks at all or declines at all. If it holds steady, then he's going to, he could still get impeached by the House, but he's going to pretty easily survive an impeachment trial in the Senate.
Craig, thanks for joining us today.
Anytime.
That's Craig Gilbert, Washington Bureau Chief at the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, looking at Wisconsin's congressional delegation and how it's treating issues of impeachment. The Marquette Law School poll is releasing its latest survey on how Wisconsin voters feel about impeachment next week. We'll talk about that next Wednesday here on Central Time. Coming up, a Wisconsin church held its first polka services over the weekend. We'll talk with the pastor and the band leader about why they did it and how it went. That's coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. It's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Brad Kohlberg with a story about running races on the Ice Age Trail.
Wisconsin's Ice Age National Scenic Trail is a 1,000-mile footpath tracing Ice Age formations across the state. People are drawn to the trail for a bunch of reasons. And I recently talked to someone who's introducing people to the trail through his love of running.
Steve Streaker, race director for Arbor Rock Running. And we're at the Robert O. Cook Memorial Arboretum in Janesville, Wisconsin.
He says he was first exposed to the Ice Age Trail, like a lot of people probably are.
Just by chance, just checking out parks in the area and then noticing the little yellow marker, and then one thing leads to the next.
But it was Stephen's brother who got him to take his daily running from the road to the trail.
He was doing endurance runs on the trail, and I'm like, wow, what is this? It sounds crazy. And then slowly but surely.
And eventually he thought, maybe I should host my own trail races right here in Janesville on the Ice Age Trail.
I'm out here all the time at this place. It's a great location. And I was running with some friends, and we always would talk about this would be a great place for a trail race. And I thought I'd give it a whirl. And so I really enjoy introducing people to the sport and connecting with people that share my interests.
And it's that social component that seems to get Stephen most excited.
You just meet so many different people from different facets of pulling off a race to make it happen. And everybody was just so supportive right from the beginning, like Ice Age Trail Alliance, the local chapter.
And that's where Dennis James comes in.
My name is Dennis James. I'm the chapter coordinator for the Rock County chapter of the Ice Age Trail Alliance.
So, a little history. The Ice Age Trail goes back to the 1950s. It was the vision of Milwaukee lawyer Ray Zillmer, who loved the outdoors and wanted to highlight Wisconsin's many unique glacial features. The trail spans the state, from the St. Croix River in the west to Door County in the east, and comes as far south as Janesville in Rock County.
In Rock County, we have 21 sustained miles. We hope to add another 40 in the next decade or two.
And that's the thing. The Ice Age Trail is still a work in progress, and it takes a lot of volunteer hours to maintain and improve the trail.
The way I look at it is if I have one person for 3 hours and they can only give me 3 hours a year, that's 3 hours I wouldn't have had otherwise.
And Stephen agrees. He's logged tons of hours on the trail to get it race ready.
The trails just don't appear. You know, they have to be maintained, and the volunteers, those people are unbelievable.
But he loves the work, and it's all worth it when the crowds show up on race day.
That, to me, is a really important part of what I'm trying to do, is getting people back out into nature and their environment.
All right, welcome, everybody. Steve Stricker from Arbor Rock Running. Thanks a lot for coming out on this beautiful Saturday morning.
Go ahead. So I run trail runs. My name is Doreen Deesh from New Glarus, and I run trail runs. I've only just begun starting.
My name is Laura Miller, and I often run by myself in up at the New Glarus Woods, and I've fallen in love with this. Through watching my children do cross country and everything else, I can't think of a better place to run. So,
My name is Deanne Klein. I'm from McFarland, Wisconsin, and trail running is a great opportunity to get out and actually enjoy nature a little bit and to get a little exercise as opposed to road running.
So okay, so Steve Bazin, and I'm from Madison, and the reason I run trails is I work in a office desk job, and I need to get out more.
It seems that a lot of them are for good causes, like this one's for Ice Age. I did one last week for a state park, and the atmosphere is much different. It's calmer, and the people are so kind, and everybody's smiling and saying hi, and it's just a lovely place to be.
Yeah, it's all about nature, so I love it. Thank you.
Stephen Streaker is race director for Arbor Rock Running, and Dennis James is volunteer coordinator for the Rock County chapter of the Ice Age Trail Alliance. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Wisconsin Public Television in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook. I'm Brad Calder.
Now, when you think of church music, there's probably a certain sound that comes to mind. Maybe it's an organ or a choir, maybe an acoustic guitar and a couple vocalists. But what about this?
Lamb of God, you take away the sins of the world. Grant us peace.
That's from this past Sunday morning at First Lutheran Church in Beaver Dam. It was their first ever polka service with music provided by the Good Time Dutchmen, a band from Kewaskum. James Wendt joins us now, pastor at First Lutheran. Pastor Jim, welcome to Central Time.
Well, thank you. I'm glad to be here today.
And Ralph Thull is leader and accordionist of the Good Time Dutchman. Ralph, nice to have you here as well.
Well, hello. How are you doing?
Good. Pastor Jim, how did the polka service come about?
Well, the congregation had, first of all, been without a pastor for a few years, and once I was called and came on board, I was asked, what do I think about a polka service that an individual by the name of Polka Bob kind of wanted to bring forth and have it as our source of worship, music, leadership. And I was really all on board right away, just listening to your intro to this segment. Right away when I heard that, it took me back to when I was a kid, New Glarus, Monroe, and part of my heritage and part of where I come from. And I gave the two thumbs up and I said, let's do it.
And Ralph, as a polka musician, what's it like playing in a church as opposed to your more typical polka party?
It's okay. You're laid back. You know, you got to act your age. but yeah, it's nice. I like it. My musicians in the band have no problems with it, and it's good. You get the people to participate a lot. Some people sing, you know, when there's polka music playing that don't sing otherwise. But yeah, I enjoy it.
And Pastor Jim, I know music in the congregations, any congregation can be controversial. Was everybody pretty much on board with this?
I know there was at least a couple that were a little weary. Just And I'm not sure if it was as much as the type, the style, but maybe, you know, maybe having too much fun, or maybe kind of what sometimes can go along with having fun, like a good old polka band on a Saturday night. You know, it could have been something more in that line, but to actually witness it on a Sunday morning, the sound of the trumpet or the accordion is quite spiritual in itself, and it, you could tell that it was really hard to keep people from smiling, from swaying, and as Ralph said, singing.
And Ralph, how much do you have to tweak your playlist to play at church?
We have, you know, songs that we got church words, and then we put polka songs to it, and waltz or whatever, foxtrots. It wasn't very hard to do.
All right. And Pastor Jim, do you think you want to do this again? Will you bring polka back into the church?
I would love to see it as an annual event. I have heard other parishioners also suggest that we should once a year, or at least on an annual basis, have the polka service. And then it is also yoked up with a harvest meal. So it's a nice way of celebrating the season of fall, and I really do think it's celebrating our heritage, our ethnic heritage, but also part of our Lutheran heritage.
We'll leave it there. Pastor Jim, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you very much.
And Ralph, thanks for sharing this with us.
Yeah, thank you.
I've been talking to Pastor James Wendt from First Lutheran Church in Beaver Dam, and Ralph Thull, leader and accordionist of the polka band The Good Time Dutchman. We talked to them about the church's first polka services that were held last weekend. Forget the promo. We'll just listen to some polka music. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up tomorrow at 6:30 on The Morning Show, Wisconsin Congressional Representative Ron Kind joins the show for a look at impeachment, trade, and other big issues facing Congress. That's tomorrow morning at 6:30 on The Morning Show. Now, how often you go to a fast food joint and use the drive-thru?
Welcome to Quickie Burger. May I take your order?
Yeah, 2 Frozy Fudge Blasts.
Will that be all?
Yeah, I think that'll, who are we kidding? Throw in a number 4.
You won't be able to do that at new restaurants in Minneapolis. The city council there recently passed an ordinance banning the construction of new drive-through windows at fast food places. Existing ones get to stay there. The idea here is to cut down on greenhouse gas emissions from idling cars. Other cities have banned new drive-throughs as well, citing less litter, improving pedestrian safety, and enhancing walkability. Some are also doing it, they say, to cut down on obesity. They point to some research that seems to show it may work. There's other research that shows it probably won't. Hank Cardello is a senior fellow at the Hudson Institute, director of their Food Policy Center. He's the author of the book Stuffed, an insider's look at who's really making America fat and how the food industry can fix it. He's a former food industry executive. Hank, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you so much. I appreciate the invitation.
So are people in Minneapolis and these other communities going to be healthier if they stop, if they don't have new drive-thrus, new fast food drive-thrus?
Well, I profess to be a skeptic on this one just because I've seen the unintended consequences of some of these regulations. And I envision if this happens, all the extra trips made by Uber Eats and DoorDash and Grubhub will actually increase the level of emissions. So I do have concerns about this solving that problem.
Right. You don't buy this as a way to make us healthier. Is there a regulation that might get us eating less unhealthy food as you see it?
You know, there have been attempts to do that. I mean, soda taxes were very in vogue a couple of years ago. And there are some metropolitan areas, let's say Boulder, Colorado, Berkeley, California, where they are seeing declines in soda consumption. But one of the things that is not done is they don't look at something called the substitution effect. In other words, if I drink less soda, what else do I consume? And none of that analysis has been done. And we've seen in other places that it really hasn't worked that well when you look at total calorie consumption across the board. So that really hasn't been as effective as it's claimed. So I haven't really seen a good one. Also in Chicago, they implemented soda taxes, and they found that people who lived in Cook County, which is where Chicago is, were taking their grocery dollars and going over the county line and doing their grocery shopping there. So they weren't really changing their habits. So, again, we haven't seen something that's really a strong, effective regulation.
All right, I want to look at a couple studies that seem to point in different directions about the idea of banning drive-through windows, at least new ones, at fast food restaurants. One in South Los Angeles, a 2015 study showed that obesity rates went up after the city banned new standalone fast food restaurants and drive-through windows. Now, that doesn't there may not be causation there, but why do you think that might happen?
Well, what happens is, there's plenty of fast food restaurants in that particular area. In South L.A., it's an area of very high obesity. So it's clear that that was a target area to try to make some improvements. But nevertheless, you still have plenty of food outlets, whether they're fast foods or other kinds of restaurants. And by banning new ones in there, it didn't really change the patterns. And, again, we did see obesity rates go up there. So what happens is you're trying to change consumer behavior. And as the companies know, to really affect change in consumer behavior, you have to spend tens of millions of dollars, if not hundreds of millions of dollars, to change the normal habits. So I think that's one strike going against some of these regulations.
Now, we reached out to a researcher in Edmonton who had looked into drive-through bans in 27 Canadian cities. We invited her to join us for this segment. She wasn't able to. But she said that restricting drive-throughs helps level the playing field with other walk-in restaurants that might offer healthier choices. So in that case, the substitution effect you were talking about might work in a healthier direction, Hank. What do you think?
Yeah, I think if you move it in that direction, for sure. I would like to see, and I generally don't call out companies, I like to see them make voluntary changes, but the restaurant industry for sure has been, they've gotten a hall pass on this entire obesity issue. They haven't done much. The programs that they have implemented really haven't made much impact, and I would like to see them sell more healthy fare. We've done analyses that show that restaurants that are selling lower calorie, better for you kinds of products are actually having gains in their sales. So it's a business imperative now. It's like you would be foolish not to do this. And there still seems to be quite a bit of resistance among certain quarters. So that's the way I'd like to see it happen, where they just do well for their business and at the same time they do better for their customers.
Talking to Hank Cardello from the Hudson Institute, talking about fast food restaurants and our health. Minneapolis and other cities around the country are banning the construction of new drive-through windows at fast food restaurants, hoping, among other things, it'll make us healthier. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think of that idea? Would you want to see your community ban the construction of new fast food drive-ups? Do you think it's a difference maker in terms of health, environmental protection, pedestrian safety is another reason people are citing? 800-642-1234. Hank, in your book, Stuffed, it seems like you're making the case that not only should restaurant owners make their fare healthier, they shouldn't necessarily tell people that they're doing it. Why is that?
Well, it's interesting. If you look at consumers who are really tuned into health, and you would, like in Madison, Wisconsin, for instance, or Boulder, Colorado, and those places, there tends to be more acute awareness of what healthy eating is. But for the most part, let's go meet 80% of our neighbors now, and it starts dropping off very radically. And what happens is the minute you say something is healthy, particularly with an indulgent product, that automatically communicates that it tastes horrible. And I'd like to talk about something called stealth health. In other words, sneak some calories out of it, you know, get rid of some of the saturated fats. I mean, in a restaurant, sometimes you order a pasta dish that's 1,400 calories and you don't know it. I don't need 1,400 calories. You could swap out 200-300 calories and never notice the difference and still make your profit and help your consumer or your customer not eat as much. So I think it's easily done if it's executed, and I'd like to see the restaurants step up and do more.
Some people have made the case, and some communities have done this, saying, okay, if you're going to sell that 1,400-calorie plate of pasta, fine, you got to post it, or you have to post at the fast food restaurant the calorie count in your meal or whatever. Do you think that's an active deterrent or educational tool for people to look at and say, wow, that's a gut bomb?
Well, clearly, first of all, I believe in full transparency. I think customers ought to know what's in their food. So I think that's just the appropriate thing to do. I think there are two audiences we're finding out, kind of like a bipolar reaction to it. Again, those who care about eating healthier are taking advantage of reading calorie counts on menu labels and seeing what's inside their products and actually impacting the decisions they make. But again, let's go to our other, let's say, more indulgent 40% in this case that we've looked at, where they don't want to know. They say, I'm going out to enjoy myself. I want to eat. I don't want somebody lecturing me about what I should or shouldn't eat. So the audiences are very different, and I think it's forcing restaurants to actually choose who their primary customer is, because it's very difficult to make all of them happy.
Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. David is with us in Gurnee, Illinois. David, hi.
Hi, thank you. Yes, I guess my point would be fast food / drive-through type restaurants, their food is so affordable. I just think the vast majority of the population, because of economical reasons, would choose to go there, hence maybe it's not as healthy, but I have not seen healthy food that's as affordable as, say, McDonald's or Burger King.
David, thanks a lot for the call. The price is right, he says, Hank.
David makes a great point. I mean, fast food restaurants can offer you your value meals and not necessarily be healthy meals, although what they are doing is they are migrating to incorporating some of these healthier ingredients. And I think what's happening now with the Impossible Burgers and Beyond Meats that are now both in restaurants and in grocery stores, I'm looking at those to be the impetus for a transition. I mean, I never would have expected a chain like Burger King to introduce the Impossible Whopper. I never would have guessed that. So if Burger King can do it, I think what you'll see is more plant-based type products and vegetable-oriented ingredients will start coming on the scene. There is disagreement about whether they're truly, quote, healthy. They're still about the same calories, and they have to add a little bit more sodium or salt to make them taste good. But for the most part, they are a better version. And then when we talk about emissions, clearly they take much less energy to make those kind of products versus, let's say, meat.
We're talking about U.S. cities banning new drive-through fast food windows. Hank Cardello is with us, senior fellow at the Hudson Institute and director of their Food Policy Center. He's the author of the book Stuffed, An Insider's Look at Who's Really Making America Fat and How the Food Industry Can Fix It. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Are you a customer of drive-through windows at fast food restaurants? If you go to fast food, do you park and walk in? Do you have food delivered? What if your community wanted to ban new drive-thrus, as Minneapolis and other places have? What would you think of that idea? If you're from Minneapolis yourself or another city that's done this, love to hear from you. Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@wpr.org. We'll pick up the conversation, maybe hear from you, coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're talking about cities banning drive-through windows at fast food restaurants. Minneapolis became one of the latest cities to do it back in August. The bans generally only prevent new drive-throughs. They don't outlaw existing ones. Hank Cardello is with us from the Hudson Institute. He directs the Food Policy Center there. He's the author of Stuffed, An Insider's Look at Who's Really Making America Fat and How the Food Industry Can Fix It. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Would you want your community to ban drive-up windows at fast food restaurants? Do you think it would make people healthier and or happier? Would you miss the drive-thru if it was gone? Call 800-642-1234. And how else do you think we could improve public health, maybe fight obesity where fast food is concerned? 800-642-1234 is the number. Carrie joins us now in Richmond. Carrie, hi.
Hi, guys. Thanks for taking my call. So I was just thinking, you know, I'm comparing apples to apples. What about the banking industry with their drive-thrus? You know, they don't have just one. They sometimes have 2, 3, 4 drive-thrus going at one time. If we're talking about obesity, I hazard to say that I think there's a lot more going on. Sure, getting people to walk into these places, but I think GMOs play a huge factor in obesity in America.
Carrie, thanks for the call. We do, I guess, sometimes make unhealthy decisions at the bank, Hank, but I think that's probably a different story, right?
Yeah, and baking products were mentioned. We've actually done some studies to identify which products were most closely related to those with obesity, and no surprise, soft drinks, but the number two on the list are the restaurant products and sweet baked goods, bakery products, donuts, packaged pastries. Those clearly are contributing. So anything we can do to get them to sell smaller sizes, I think is a way to go, or innovate, do something different with those products, come up with new versions that have less calories. I think they're major contributors.
Carrie, thanks for the call. Going on to Chuck with us in Eau Claire. Chuck, hi.
Hi. The drive-thru, I think, is convenient, and we really need it. So I don't believe banning is going to do anything to help people. The biggest help I see is the stuff that we put in to products to preserve them, and the dyes and all of those things. I think if we make the industry make products healthier, you know, instead of, you know, the way things are, I think it would help.
Chuck, thanks a lot for the call. So Chuck wants more focus on the ingredients in the food than the drive-up themselves, Hank.
Yeah, and I think clearly the packaged goods companies have done an awful lot to improve what goes into their products. I mean, even Kraft mac and cheese is making more natural colors. It's not that neon orange like it used to be. So there are improvements there. Again, I do see opportunities, though, for the restaurants to check up. Chuck also highlighted the convenience aspect, and one of the things we've learned, there's a consumer we call the fence sitters who are really trying to eat healthier, but convenience is so important to them. They're time-pressed. Many of them have kids. They have 20 minutes at night to try to assemble a dinner or pick up something, and that's really, you know, that's 25% of the population. And to take away something like a takeout really, really hurts those folks who don't have any time to begin with. They're just trying to grab a meal that works for them and their families. And I just think we need to look at other solutions that are more pragmatic and continue to press the food industry for change.
Thanks for that call. We're talking about cities banning the construction of new drive-through windows at fast food restaurants. Minneapolis, one of the biggest and latest. There are others around the country. Hank Cardello with us from the Hudson Institute. Back to your calls at 800-642-1234. Allie is with us in La Crosse. Allie, hi.
Hi, how are you doing?
Good. What do you think?
It might have been touched before, but just especially with the younger generation, the tax that the ban that they're imposing is great, but a lot of young people use like Postmates and different delivery apps. A lot of restaurants are doing that on their own. So is there anything else that we can be doing in addition to this ban that's happening in Minneapolis just to reduce carbon emissions?
Allie, thanks for the call. Allie's saying, yeah, there's a lot of the young folks are using different delivery stuff instead of going to the drive-thrus anyway, Hank.
Well, I certainly think for the millennials and what we call Gen Zers, it's more and more of the delivery services, and I think that'll only increase. Again, they're a significant portion of population, but nevertheless, you still have the other, you know, 60% of population and that are still using it. And again, what I just referenced is this convenience crowd still uses the drive-ins, and a lot of people use it, let's say, morning coffee, I mean, all day parts. So I think you have that. I do think, though, going back to the very first question, and that is what we're doing, we're talking about addressing fast food, and yet what we're doing is spewing more emissions into the atmosphere by getting more immediate delivery of not only restaurant products. I mean, we have Amazon now, Prime. All these services are increasing more and more and more, and they are adding more emissions. So I think we need to take a more holistic view to addressing this, and it's not just restaurants.
Thanks for the call, Allie. Iris joins us in Waukesha. Iris, hello.
Hello. I just wanted to say I don't think it's fair to the restaurants that get most of their money because of the convenience of a drive-thru. I don't think trying to make people eat healthier by making it harder to get the fast food. I really don't like eating. I don't eat fast food because I think it's not that good. But as far as businesses go, I don't think it's fair in the business sense to, you know, single out drive-thrus as a way to make people eat healthier.
Iris, thanks for the call. What do you think, Hank?
Yeah, I think Iris is on to something. I think we have to look at what problems we're trying to solve and what's the best way to go at it. And doing something like this, I think, doesn't consider the big picture. Oftentimes when we look at regulations, you know, to regulate, to tax, to ban, to restrict, I always ask when I speak to public health organizations that please broaden your toolkit of considerations to try to solve problems. And that is work more closely with industry to show them case studies and analyses that show them that it's just smart business to be selling healthier products and doing the right things. I mean, one of the things the packaged goods companies, speaking of emissions, are doing now, companies like Procter & Gamble and Unilever and Danone and Nestle are coming together to restrict their emissions and also the amount of plastics they use in their products. So more and more of that's happening. I wish it would happen faster, but nevertheless, it is coming, but I still think there's a huge – one of the things we're not talking about, for instance, is food waste here. When you think about it, restaurants really contribute a ton of food waste along with grocery chains, and I think that's a tremendous opportunity to reduce emissions and also help feed people with healthier products.
Time for one more caller. Raven is with us in La Crosse. Raven, hello.
Hi. I just wanted to say that not everyone is able to walk into a restaurant or a bank or some other business. I happen to be in a wheelchair. It's kind of difficult to unload the chair to get in. So places that have drive-thrus are very important. And a lot of times I won't go somewhere if there's not a drive-thru.
Interesting, Raven. Thanks for the call. Hank, 30 seconds, that's another perhaps unintended consequence she's worried about.
I think Raven nailed it right there. It's something that wasn't considered. And again, it's a convenience issue. It's a necessity. And I think we need to consider those and look broader than just limiting things like drive-thrus.
Very briefly, Hank, do you see the restaurant industry trying to make substantial changes when it comes to health?
I don't see enough. I'll be very candid with it. I wish they'd do more. They do have a program called Kids Live Well, where they have a couple of offerings that they offer for kids that are healthier and lower calories. I think they can do more. I think they're capable of doing more, and I'd like to see a commitment out of them.
Hank, thanks a lot for joining us today.
My pleasure.
That's Hank Cardello, senior fellow at the Hudson Institute and director of their Food Policy Center. He's the author of the book Stuffed, An Insider's Look at Who's Really Making America Fat and How the Food Industry Can Fix It. We talked to him about how some U.S. cities, most recently Minneapolis, are banning the construction of new drive-through windows at fast food restaurants. Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, cigarettes have been a public health story for decades, but there's also been a lot of politics surrounding tobacco. We'll get that story from the author of the new book, The Cigarette, A Political History. And the Wisconsin Science Festival is coming up. We'll talk to a guest speaker there who explores the science of the Star Wars movies. Spoiler alert, it may not all be scientifically accurate. That and more all coming up tomorrow here on Central Time.